You're listening to the Body Literacy Podcast, your connection to the art and science of feeling really good, body, mind, and spirit. I'm your host and holistic health coach, Jen Mayo. If you've never experienced truth and freedom inside your body, an amazing adventure is about to begin. Healing happens in community. Body literacy is your tribe. Join me in discovering the keys to fearlessly unlocking your body's innate intelligence and resilience. Turn on to the wisdom of your body as we connect your wellness dots by exploring whole person healing, from neuroscience and nutrition to sexual health and sleep. Join the wellness revolution and start speaking your body's language. Before we get started, I wanted to introduce you to the most profound and impactful piece of health technology I've encountered in 3 decades of navigating my own health challenges. LifeWave is a wearable health technology that uses your own light energy to optimize your health. If you've followed the Body Literacy Podcast for any period of time, you likely already know that I'm a bit of a walking science experiment. I have a passion for exploring how time-honored ancient healing arts can be coupled with modern science and technology to optimize our health, wellness, and vitality, and how we can empower ourselves with the knowledge and optimization of our own onboard wisdom and healing potential, rather than viewing the human body as a problem to be solved. LifeWave's phototherapy patches use light to stimulate the body's natural healing systems. By applying LifeWave's non-transdermal patches to specific points on the body similar to acupressure, where the patch covers the skin, infrared light emitted from the body is reflected back into the tissue, stimulating specific regions of the brain and tapping into the body's own flow of energy and the ability to heal itself. LifeWave patches are not intended to treat any specific condition or disease, but rather support the body's own innate healing mechanisms. When we take a holistic approach to health and consider there is really only one state of dis-ease in the body, imbalance, rather than the 32,000 diseases defined by conventional medicine, rebalancing the body and supporting our own built-in capacity to heal becomes a journey of ease rather than a frustrating and disempowering struggle to control dis-ease. Energy medicine operates by a different set of rules than material medicine. I talk about experience-based medicine a lot, and LifeWave is simply a therapy you have to take for a test drive to feel the benefits for yourself. To learn more or try them out, just visit jenmayo.com/LifeWave. On this episode of the Body Literacy Podcast, I'm joined by Brendan Murata. Brendan is a filmmaker, author, podcaster, public speaker, and father. His last film, American Circumcision, won multiple awards and played on Netflix. He's the author of The Intactivist Guidebook, The Haunting of Bob Cratchit, and Children's Justice. He has spoken at Yale University, the International Conference on Men's Issues, the International Symposium on Genital Autonomy and Children's Rights, and the Association for Pre- and Perinatal Psychology. Brendan hosts a regular podcast called The Brenda Murata Show, and he currently lives with his family in Austin, Texas. Thank you for joining us on the podcast, Brendan.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have a new book out called Children's Justice, which for anybody who's looking at the video version, I have this right here. It's a great book, and it kind of takes a broader look at some social justice issues that expand on a film and some work you've done in the past. So I'd like to spend more time talking about the book and the concepts that it covers, but as kind of an introduction for anybody in our audience who isn't already familiar with your work, if you could give us kind of a background to how you got into the social justice work, but you created a film called American Circumcision, which kind of landed you on the map. If you could tell us a little bit more about that and the intactivism movement that surrounds that.
So there's a whole lot of history there, but the short version is that I did a documentary called American Circumcision, which explores the issue of circumcision in America and the intactivist movement, which says that all human beings should have the right to make their own choices about their bodies. Mm-hmm. So this being a podcast that I, as I understand it, focuses on body literacy, knowing whether or not you have your whole body is probably an important part of body literacy.
Absolutely.
And it's something that, you know, it's funny. The first question people usually ask me is, how'd you become interested in this? But it's almost strange to me because, you know, if you had a part of your body chopped off, I think most people would be interested in it. Like if you were just missing your hand and you were talking to people and you said like, someone did this when I was a child and then I don't really remember it and I don't know why they did it. And someone said, oh, well, they chop everyone's hands off as a child. You'd be like, that's a little, should we talk about this? That seems strange.
Exactly. You
know? Oh, but no, it's fine. It's just the most sensitive part of your body, the most intimate, the most that's entwined with your gender and your sexuality. So I'm sure it's, you know, like, I feel like that's a thing we should talk about. So my interest initially was just that I was curious about the subject. I was going through a process of self-development that I suspect a lot of the people you've worked with have gone through, where you start questioning all the different things in your past and different feelings come up. You notice the emotional patterns you were taught as a child and start to change some of those. But this obviously is one I couldn't change.
Right.
So, or at least not physically, or at least I didn't think I could.
Right.
And so I was curious about that and it bothered me. And I have talents as a filmmaker. That's what I've wanted to do my whole life. And so to basically educate people about this, I made that film because I was doing all the research myself. I was, all the interview subjects in my film were people whose websites and books I'd been looking up my own. And I had one of my interview subjects calls the obsessive epiphany, which is when you're just researching everything you can on a subject.
Right.
And I suspect, it's funny because I did that back in, I started working on it back in 2011. Mm-hmm. And now I think even more people have gone through that process. They just have different names for it. Mm-hmm. They call it getting woke or getting red pilled, or, there's all these like different sort of names people have created for like, wait a minute, like something's not quite right here. We need to investigate this. So right. That was the genesis of the film. It did really well. You can still find it on circumcisionmovie.com. It was on Netflix for a short period. And now I think the best places to find it are Vimeo, Amazon, and it's either on Tubi or IMDb right now, free with ads. I don't know which, but anyway, so that was how I got interested in the subject matter and my initial education on it. And then I talk about this in the introduction of the book. A lot of the activists that I met were talking about this through a human rights perspective. And one of the things studying this issue made me realize is that there's a broader way that we think about and the way that we treat children. Mm-hmm. So all of the excuses that people give for doing something like circumcision reveal really strange attitudes about children. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, he won't remember it later. It's like, I've heard that excuse used on adults and it's usually a part of rape culture. So What's going on here?
Right.
And then I just, with everything going on in the world, I mm-hmm. became aware, there's obviously been a massive interest in social justice issues.
Right.
And the issues that, and the topics that people frame that way seem to have a different reception and different way of talking about things than just, human rights issues. And I view the way that we treat children like that is everything. Mm-hmm. It's very often this issue is sort of framed as like something small or niche or, whatever. But I actually feel like the way that we treat children determines everything in society, because the way that we socialize children, the way that we treat them when you're young creates the attitudes and ways of relating and emotional base that they're going to use for the rest of their life. So if that base is solid, then people are going to relate to each other in a way that's very loving and nurturing in all the ways that they were treated as a child. And if it's not, then we're going to have a world that looks maybe a little bit more like the one we're in now. Mm-hmm. So that's a very broad overview of what my, how I got from the film to the book. But a 100,000, like you said, it's 100,000 word book. So
Right. Yeah. You were mentioning, I was saying before we started recording that I was listening to one of your podcasts regarding your creative process for writing the book. And you were talking about this flow state that you were in while you were writing it, and it just kind of came out of you and transformed from something that you thought was going to be, a very brief description of things into something much more expansive, but you felt almost like it was something that was meant to be and channeled through you. Like it wasn't even a choice to write, but you were just sort of flow state writing it, which I think is really poignant.
it was a very forceful flow state.
Yeah.
The book sort of came to me and demanded to be written.
Yeah. But
I'm glad it did. I think it came out well. So
absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't seem like it, because circumcision really is such a profound thing. It doesn't seem like this should be something so difficult to talk about. It seems like it should be in your face. Why do you suppose, particularly in American culture, and your film is called American Circumcision specifically, why do you think it's such a hard topic for people to approach?
The topic itself is very simple. Mm-hmm. Like, people have the right to their own body. You know, like, don't be nice to children. Don't cut parts of their body off. Right. Like, it's very simple, right? Like, we could,
Dan,
thank you for listening to the podcast, you know. Yeah. But the cultural constructions around it are really complex.
Right.
So it intersects with sexuality. It intersects with how we treat children. Mm-hmm. It intersects with culture and religion and medicine. And all of these issues that people have really strong social programming around.
Yeah.
And so I think the issue itself is very simple, and the cultural barriers around it are very complex. And the untangling of those cultural barriers is the real challenge. In the book, there's a political term I discovered that I think really captures it, which is cultural hegemony. Mm-hmm. So the concept of cultural hegemony is that there's a dominant culture that serves and is intended to serve people who are in power. So a lot of the ideas that we're taught aren't really meant, I think this is especially true as children. A lot of the things we're told as children aren't necessarily meant to serve us, mm-hmm. but the people around us. Mm-hmm. And cultural hegemony is a term that usually, you know, historically it's been used in like Marxist criticism of, you know, there's the dominant ruling class, and then they tell everyone else things like, oh, hard work builds character, and people who have more power and wealth than you are there because they earned it, and stuff like that.
Right.
And I take it a step further and I say all of these like larger political things that people are dealing with, at some point, the only reason that they wouldn't reject those is because in childhood, they internalized emotional ways of relating that were similar. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look at totalitarianism, just look at an abusive family, right? Like that's right. Sort of the genesis of it. And so I think that the reason it's sometimes difficult for people to talk about is because they've got all of this cultural programming, and the process of naming that mm-hmm. can take a while. So, you know, all of that cultural programming took a lifetime to create. And I think we can get a lot of it in a 1-hour podcast, but I don't know if we'll get all of it.
You
know?
Right. Exactly.
Might take a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I will say, and just to give you a little perspective on how I come to the trauma-informed space, I largely got into this line of work through a number of experiences, both with my own health, as I think so many people who come to a holistic space often do, as well as some experiences I had in a hospital environment and understanding the hierarchical structures that exist inside the medical system. But I had a personal experience when I was a child that involved being medically sexually violated. And I think this is a term that very few people have heard or understand the concept of medical sexual violence. And in my case, you know, it wasn't nearly to the extent of having part of my body removed, but certainly there was a medical procedure involved that my body received in the same way that somebody who was being sexually assaulted might have. And certainly at the age of 5, which is when that happened to me, I didn't have the mental capacity to process that the way an adult would. So that's largely how I got very interested in this subject matter, as well as there are just lots of men in my life who are obviously affected by this, whether they have a conscious awareness of that or not. So I feel like my giving a voice to it, because I was post-verbal when it happened to me, and I do have a pretty good vivid memory of what happened and how I experienced that experience, perhaps lends me well, to give a voice to people who probably didn't have a voice at the time. So I think there are a lot of things to explore in the medical culture, particularly with regards to authority. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I feel like a lot of what we're experiencing, not only in this issue specifically, but just in the medical culture at large, has a lot to do with our relationship with authority.
Man, that's like 4 or 5 chapters of the book. I don't know how much of that I can fit into this. I appreciate you sharing your own experience, and I'm curious about that because one of the things I talk about in the book is that the medical culture ideology uses a lot of framing and discourse to hide what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the simplicity of both of our experiences is that if someone touches or does something to your body that you don't want, right, in any other context, we would call that sexual assault or rape, you know, depending on like what it is that they're doing. Exactly. But medical discourse will say, oh no, well, we're doing a medical procedure. And because we're giving it that name,
right,
even though the emotions and the body reaction and all of those things
exactly the same,
exactly the same, the name that they're using hides it.
Right.
And all of the sort of discourse and the uniforms and the degrees and all of these things. And so the name that I give it in the book is systemic pedophilia. And the reason I use that name is because there's a system. Mm-hmm. There's the medical system specifically in this case.
Right.
That, and then there is a child who is being sexually assaulted. And that assault is not being carried out by one person. It's being carried out by a system. In other words,
exactly,
if you were to remove any one person from the system, it's still like not one person is totally, you know, if you talk to the doctors, they'll say, well, the parents wanted us to do this. If you talk to the parents, the doctors had told us we had to do this. Everyone sort of passes the blame. Mm-hmm. And that is how cultural systems work, is that there's not one person. There's all these social constructions and belief systems and language that all say, oh, it's okay. They won't remember it. In this case, it's fine.
Right.
And I talk about in the book also that I use that term, you know, a lot of people, when they think of that term, they think of that there's a, like a desire on the part of the adult, mm-hmm, but because it's a system carrying it out, there's not, you know, systems don't have desire. And we're not talking about there the intent of the adult, but the impact on the child. In other words, right, if you were to center in on the adult and say, well, does the adult enjoy it or not? Like, it doesn't matter. And what matters is that the child is being harmed. And right, that's actually what makes something pedophilia or sexual assault, is that whether or not their boundaries are violated.
Right.
So medical culture, I think, has built into it a certain intentional grooming, mm-hmm, through the authority frame of the doctor, where the doctor says, you have to do this. And when someone puts up resistance in some way, they're a bad patient. Mm-hmm. And there's all of these sort of tools to break that resistance down. And then also select for people who will become doctors who accept an authority frame and will just carry out what that system wants. Mm-hmm. And then select for patients who will go with what the doctor says.
Right.
So that's part of the reason it's also hard to talk about, is if you try to find the individual who's responsible. I don't know your particular situation, but I would guess that people you've talked with about it have tried to suggest that you bring it up with one person. Well, if you talk to the doctor, mm-hmm, right?
Right.
Is that like, yeah, there, because they're trying to find the one person, but it's not one person, it's a system.
Right. And I think there are so many power structures, and certainly the last couple of years, I think, has lent itself well to those of us who want to explore that space, to really look at the power structures of so many different systems, whether it's the medical system or the educational system or business or religion. I came across some videos and some things regarding the agentic state, and that really resonated with me, that, you know, and this certainly applied to like things that happened
concept,
with
the, so you might have
yeah
to let me
so
know.
I'm not sure if you've ever heard of the Milgram experiments.
Yeah, oh, I've heard of the Milgram experiment.
Yeah, I mean that basically describes the agentic state. So whereby there is kind of the passing of the buck. So whereby somebody is doing something because there's an authority figure who told them to do it, so they can just kind of say, well, I wasn't doing it, I was just doing my job sort of thing. So I think there's a lot of that in the medical culture whereby, you know, a nurse is performing something because the doctor above her told her to, the doctor's doing something because the administrator at the hospital said he had to, and the administrator at the hospital says, well, the FDA or the CDC said I have to, blah, 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 whatever. So there's this kind of hierarchical passing of the buck so that nobody ever actually has to claim responsibility for the negative consequences that actually manifest with the individual patient or with a cohort of patients in this case.
Yeah, the term in social justice for that is complicity.
Okay.
So they're all complicit in a system.
Got it.
In other words, there might be an individual perpetrator who carries out the act, but in order for that to occur, there have to be a lot of people who are complicit.
Right.
In other words, there might be one doctor doing it, but the hospital administrators know what's going on. Right. And the parents sometimes know what's going on, although parents are often groomed by that same system as much as anyone else. Mm-hmm. But you know, in order for that to occur, everyone has to abdicate responsibility to a certain degree.
I love the fact that you just used the word grooming, because so often we think of that term in terms of sexual predators in a more traditional sense, but really the same thing is largely happened in a more sanctioned setting in the medical environment in this particular case, but the constructs of it are very similar.
Yeah, if we think about that term as just the things that a predator or predatory system does to make someone have weaker boundaries or be more willing to allow something to happen to them or be in a situation where they can't fight back against what's happening to them, it fits perfectly. I mean, and in this case, especially with the issue of genital cutting of circumcision, there is something happening to a child that impacts their sexuality. So the various things that the hospital system or the medical system does to create circumstances where that can happen could absolutely be described as grooming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with regards to the sexuality aspect, because I think that really gets glossed over or passed over in exploring the space, especially with regards to parent education. I don't know of many parents who have ever had doctors specifically discuss their child's future sexuality. But I think in the case of circumcision, you don't know what you don't know. And if you've only been part of a culture that has practiced this, and you're not privy to people or to men who have had, you know, sexual experiences with their full intact penis, they don't have the experience to know what's potentially being missed either for either sex. Can you expand a little bit on, you know, that aspect of it?
Well, again, there's culture around that.
Right.
So if you talk to women in cultures where female genital cutting is the norm, they will tell you it's cleaner, it's healthier, their sex life is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. I interview more than one woman from genital cutting cultures in my film. One is a woman who helped get the legislation passed against female genital cutting in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the other is an anthropologist who willingly chose it and says, it's part of my culture and I think it's great. Mm-hmm. So with all of this, there's those cultural constructs. And I think that those cultural constructs are actually so strong that they will sometimes even color people's actual lived experience. So if you are someone who was circumcised, you can feel the area above the scar line and below the scar line. And if you run your finger along it very lightly, you might notice that the part above is more sensitive, and that's the remaining foreskin tissue. Mm-hmm. So you can, even if you don't have the comparative experience of having had that body part as an adult, you can still feel the remnant and know, oh, like this feels different than the other part. And more of that other part that felt good would probably be more good, you know, but because there's all these cultural constructs around it. And then of course, if you are willing to explore those sensations or what that might mean. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, again, cultural constructions that are sort of trying to prevent that. And the term I use for it in the book is false consciousness. So mm-hmm. admitting, like seeing what actually happened to you might bring up some feelings. And if you maybe are not ready yet to explore those feelings, then what people will do is they'll build psychological defenses and try to push those down. Mm-hmm. And because that there's, you know, so there's a larger culture that maybe doesn't want people to explore those feelings, sometimes those psychological defenses can even be created by the dominant culture. They sure. will create all sorts of ideas or sayings. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that if you don't really know where you heard something, then it's mm-hmm. probably part of the dominant culture. People will say like, oh, it's cleaner. And you're like, where did you hear that?
Right.
What's your source for that? What is that cleaner than what?
Exactly.
And it's like, everybody knows that's what we've heard. Like that's cultural hegemony. That's mm-hmm. that's a dominant culture that's telling you things that under any kind of intellectual scrutiny completely fall apart and don't actually serve you, but definitely serve the system that wants to keep doing stuff to children.
Right, right. Do you suppose the act of circumcision is part of a bigger cultural narrative of setting people, and in this case, children, up from a very young age to be submissive?
It's hard to answer that question because I don't think that any of this is conscious.
Right.
In other words, I mean, at one point it might have been. So if you look at the early medical literature around circumcision, that was all written by Victorian doctors, and it was very clearly intended to harm sexuality. But in the Victorian era, they saw this as like some great thing that they were going to get rid of. And, you know, that sexuality was somehow bad or harmful. And now I would say that whatever is continuing is unconscious and right. probably based in trauma. Mm-hmm. In other words, I talk about this at the end of the book. If you think of trauma as almost like a separate organism, like yeah. a virus, you know, it's yeah. something that we don't want. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get out. Our bodies naturally want to process and get rid of trauma. Mm-hmm. If you think of it, though, as a separate organism, it's going to go through the same evolutionary process any virus does. Mm-hmm. And a virus that is going to be more successful at reproducing in an environment where the immune system is weakened in some way. So if you can get in really early and weaken your immune system, that creates a better environment for more trauma.
Sure.
And so I sort of view it like trauma as being the original source of most of these things, and it's unconscious, and it may not even be a part of us, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I know that might sound like a strange thing, but I think that our bodies and ourselves naturally want to process it out. And at the same time, when people get infected with trauma, they tend to want to pass it like a virus. And if you view it that way as almost a spiritual virus or emotional or psychological, I think it makes a lot more sense. So the original, you know, you say like, is it intentional? Is it like, maybe it was at one point, maybe there are some people within the system who are aware of that and benefiting from it in some way, but I think most of it's unconscious.
Okay. And I guess I mean more on a systemic level. I don't think there are specifically doctors thinking like, oh, let's enact this so that we can create more submissive people. But on a systemic whole, do you feel like it primes people to yield to authority?
Well, if you look at the original beginnings of circumcision as a medical practice, mm-hmm. one of the things I found as I was researching that was a speech by Michel Foucault, who's this French philosopher that's yeah. been very influential in social justice circles, where he talks about the origins of medicalized circumcision. I was shocked when I found this because I've been following this issue a long time. And here's the most influential social justice philosopher talking about it. And I'd never heard this before. And what he says and what he argues in his history of it is that basically the doctors involved knew that there's absolutely no way, you know, circumcision was originally proposed as a cure for masturbation. So mm-hmm. it was seen as this great evil in the Victorian era. And that if you just remove the most sensitive part of the body, then people would stop doing that. Right.
Right. Right.
And what he says is that they knew that was the dumbest thing. Like, that was never going to work. You couldn't get rid of it. But by creating something which they could never actually solve, they could unlimitedly expand their power trying to solve it. And that the actual goal of that campaign was to gain power over children's bodies. In other words, there is a interest in what he calls biopower, basically that if you can extend, if you can control the bodies and lives of your population, then the state has a lot more power. They can grow the pop, you know, they can do all sorts of more things. And that the ability to control your citizens' bodies and your population is actually way more important than what he calls sovereign power, which is what most people think of when they think of power, which is the ability to say, you know, off with their head, I'm the king. He says, if you can control their bodies, that's actually way more influential. And so controlling children's bodies and children's sexuality is, if you get in there, then you have them for the rest of their life. And so he sees the initial campaign to against masturbation, which involves circumcision and created that as a medical practice, as an attempt to control children's sexualities from the beginning and to gain control over their bodies. And he says prior, you know, parents were the ones who had power over their children. And so he said, there's this, you know, what they created this discourse, said, your child has this problem. It's your job as a parent to watch them, which is like also kind of creepy, even though that was like, if you read their original writings, that's the language they're using. And then the moment happens, call the doctor, and he's the only one who can actually solve the problem. So it turned parents into agents for the doctor and forced them to be complicit in that system. And I mean, I you know, if you look at how the medical world works, I think that that pattern repeats, where they say this thing, which is actually very normal, is a problem. You need to give us a massive increase in our power to stop it. And then, oh, we couldn't actually stop it, but we're going to keep the power, right? Not that there's anything that's happened in recent years that is similar to that at all. This, we're just talking about history in the Victorian era.
There are some things, though, that have happened in recent history that seem to have expanded the powers of the medical establishment.
No idea what you're talking about.
Ways that may not be easy to reverse. But no, I don't know what I'm talking about either. You make kind of a jump or a shift from the film, which was made, what, roughly 5 years ago, to the children's justice book, from going from talking about circumcision specifically as a human rights issue to being a more epistemic injustice issue or social justice issue, or you talk about critical theory. Why does that distinction matter, and how does that manifest in the solution potentially?
So there's a couple different things there. I think initially my interest came from the fact that I was just watching people who were doing human rights activism not get anywhere. I was watching people who were doing social justice activism get really far. And so it was just a very practical, like, I intellectually feel like the idea, you know, I have the rights to my own body, my body, my rights. That makes sense to me. But when I actually look at how the world is going, that doesn't seem to be doing very well, but the other stuff seems to be doing really well. Why is that? And just having the humility to go, okay, like, I intellectually feel one thing, but what actually is going on here? Is there something that they understand that I don't? And I think that the key distinction actually relates to what we were talking about earlier. It has to do with power and scope. So if you say that the issue of you know, genital cutting is that we need to give people the rights to their own body, the scope of power is that we need to end genital cutting. It's this, you know, it's this one thing that we're going to change. And it, also, if you frame it in terms of human rights, the enforcer of human rights is the state. And you're saying, hey, you're almost, it's almost like you're asking like the parents to do it for you. Like, hey, it's not fair. You need to change that. And so I noticed there's sort of an impotence in human rights activism where you're sort of asking someone, you're saying, I have this right and you need to respect this right, But the person who's going to enforce that is not actually you, it's outside. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you look at the way that social justice frames things, they say the problem is a system. So our scope of power that we're working is not just changing this one thing. We actually need to transform the entire system. And then you can start to see the ways that the system is complicit in this. So if it's a human rights thing, there's one person who did the violation. If it's a system, then you actually need to transform the whole system. And all of those other forms of power that they're using become visible. In other words, if we're just saying that genital cutting is the problem, though, then we have to change that one thing. But that comes as a part of a sales funnel. So there's this larger set of cultural constructs where like, oh, you have to have your child in the hospital. That's the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. And when you come in, there's the consent form you have to sign. Sometimes it's a blanket consent form. It's not just one for that. And the nurses might ask you 8 or 9 times. And so you can go through that system and say no, but why is there this giant system that's pressuring you to do something that's harmful? Like, can we talk about that? That, you know, well, you, in the human rights model, well, you're an individual. You just make a choice. No, like, there's all these cultural constructs and all these other things. Like, why I'm an individual, but they're a multi-billion dollar industry. That doesn't seem like a fair fight, right? Mm-hmm. And so in order to make that a fair fight, you have to start looking at all those other things and look at the system itself. Mm-hmm. And so what shifted for me was that I began looking at not just the argument, so to speak, or like the logical, you know, this is what I think is correct, or this is how we should treat people, but the forms of power mm-hmm. that were being used. Mm-hmm. And okay, we have this argument that's makes sense. I mean, you know, we don't actually even need the human rights where you say like, don't touch kids or hurt kids. Right. Do we even need an ideology to say that? Right. But I think where the stuff that I've done with children's justice is useful is that now there's an ability to talk about all the other things going on around that. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, there's like, I know we're right about this, but I don't understand why it's not like when we make these arguments, it's not working because there's a huge, massive, you know, power in the form of language and social constructs and all these other things. Right. And so the book is very much exploring that. Mm-hmm. And that, again, if we're talking about all of the power in society, that's a very long conversation.
Right.
But right. That's what the book is about.
Right. Right. Why do you think, you know, especially looking at doctors who are challenging the system, why do you think stepping outside of the status quo in medicine is so challenging?
Because there's a system set up against it. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, medical schools select for complicity. Mm-hmm. So you have to do well in high school, which again is a compulsory system that we force children into. Mm-hmm. And if you are really obedient there and you do everything everyone tells you to, then you go to college. And if you're also really obedient there and you do everything everyone tells you to, then you can go to medical school. And medical school is an incredibly high pressure environment where you don't actually have time to process or feel your emotions. You just have to go, go, go and learn. And it's really intense. Mm-hmm. And then you go to residency. So you go mm-hmm. to a hospital. And if you do bad in your residency, then the sunk costs of college tuition, all of your time in school, and all of your medical school time and tuition is lost. Mm-hmm. So do what we say, or 8 years and over $100,000 is gone.
Yeah.
So then they put you in front of a child, and the circumcisions are often done by medical residents mm-hmm. as practice. So the mm-hmm. person doing this to a child is often like, they're just some med student basically. Mm-hmm. And they show you how to do one and they say, okay, good. Now you do one. Do you have time to emotionally process that in that situation?
Right.
Like, is there any, you know, and so like, there's just, you've been doing, obeying, like mm-hmm. what's one more? And so like, what would it take to in that situation with 8 years, over $100,000 and, you know, again, the type of person who has chosen to go through that system. So mm-hmm. they have their own complicity and all that. Hold on. Oh, and all of the cultural norms around circumcision, right? That it is seen as a normal thing to do. You're not going to get in trouble if you do it.
Right.
To go, hold on, I want to be with my feelings here, Philomela. And I don't know if this is ethically, can we talk about this? Mm-hmm. Like it's, the whole system is designed to just push through that.
Right.
And in the book, I sort of compare it to like a gang initiation where mm-hmm. If you're already complicit, then you're going to be less likely to question or rat on the rest of the system. In other words, they've got one on you, so you're not going to talk about the ones that they've done.
Right, right. What you just described brought up in my mind's eye, there were a series of articles that came out a few years ago regarding medical students and residents being enlisted during not even necessarily gynecological surgeries, but just surgeries where women were unconscious and practicing pelvic exams on them while they were unconscious, usually without consent. Yeah. And I think there is so much of this almost hazing kind of ritual that goes into students and residents not feeling like they have permission to even ask questions if they want to continue participating in that system. But there's been a handful that have said, no, this is absolutely wrong. And I don't know if you've read, Jennifer Block wrote a book called Everything Below the Waist, which talks about a lot of the medical sexual violence that occurs more from a female perspective and not necessarily in childhood, but that really expands upon that. And I think there's...
I haven't read it, but I'm writing it down right
now. Yeah, write that one down. She's really good. I would love to get her on sometime. She did a very good job of compiling a lot of information more on in the OBGYN realm of things. But yeah, that's a great one. And kind of on the female aspect, going back, because you kind of touched on why female circumcision has kind of universally, at least in Western culture, been demonized, and we wouldn't even think twice about allowing that to be normal medical practice again. Why do you think there's such a disparity that we still consider it okay to practice genital cutting on infant boys, but not on girls?
I think it's two things. It's our cultural constructions around gender. Mm. Then it's just the racism and imperialism of that one is done by brown people and one is done by white people. Mm-hmm. So female genital cutting is usually practiced. It's practiced in African cultures and in certain Muslim cultures.
Yep.
And one of them is seen as medicalized Western science, and the other is seen as some sort of weird tribal, traditional religious thing. And even though the ethics of them are the same, you know, cutting a child is cutting a child regardless of their gender, mm-hmm. there's a different perception there.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I think is perceived as different is that we relate to gender and men's bodies and women's bodies differently. Mm-hmm. And so when I interviewed the anthropologist I mentioned who'd undergone female genital cutting, she is an expert in a lot of the early myths and stories around genital cutting. And one of the things that she told me is that in the oldest African myths around genital cutting, it's seen as creating gender. So the feminine element of the man is removed, the foreskin, which is wet, it's enveloping and mobile, soft. They remove that. And then from the woman, the masculine element is removed, which is the clitoris. It's erectile tissue. It sticks out. It's almost like a small penis. And so they remove those elements from each to create gender, according to this traditional myth. Mm-hmm. And what she said is she thought that the reason that Western feminists were so incensed over female genital cutting was that they'd fought really hard to play the masculine role. Sure. And if you tell a woman to like get back in the kitchen or something like that, that's like one of the most offensive things you can say because you're telling them like, oh, you're not allowed to play this role. And so removing the sort of metaphorical aspect of the masculine is seen as like almost the same thing, like telling them to get back out of a particular role. Whereas we haven't gone through that around men. And this was the piece I realized listening to her is if you tell a man, oh, get back to work, that's not like, that's almost seen as a normal thing to say. Right. And removing the feminine element from men culturally is seen as actually a good thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole series of slurs that are just directed towards men who are in some way too feminine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's only in the past couple years that there's been a little bit of gender freedom there, but even then I don't think there's much.
Yeah.
And so I think it has to do also with our ideas about gender that we see. And there's also, if you go back to like sort of the traditional patriarchal ideas, we need to protect women. Women's bodies are somehow, you know, damsel in distress. They're more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Whereas men historically have gotten their status and sense of value from mm-hmm. sacrificing their well-being for others. So as we make women sex objects, but we make men success objects. Mm-hmm. So if men are willing to sacrifice their well-being for the good of the tribe, be it through work, be it through being a warrior or battle or something like that, that is seen as like what their role is in society. Mm-hmm. And a man saying, no, I don't want to do that. Or let me be with my feelings and see if I want to sacrifice my, you know, to quote the comedian Bill Burr, why is there a double standard here? Bullets hurt me too.
Right.
I think there's something there where if a man questions that, then if the tribe is counting on him to sacrifice in that way for their protection, then maybe they're not safe if he does that. Mm-hmm. And you can even see it in traditional, like, you know, male female dynamics. Like if the man isn't protecting, am I safe? Right.
Right.
Whereas what I talk about in the book is that actually a man being willing to go against culture, mm-hmm. again, you know, to sacrifice his well-being to protect children is the traditional protecting masculine role, right? We want men to say like, no, you're not going to hurt the children. Mm-hmm. That's what we want them to do. And in this case, doing that requires sacrificing a certain short-term emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have to actually, to do that, question your culture, be with your feelings, mm-hmm. see or maybe feel some stuff that initially might be very challenging,
right.
But that is actually playing the traditional masculine role. It's just that we've got a whole lot of programming around the previous role and not a lot of nuance. And of course, there's a lot of larger cultural systems that would really benefit from men not questioning them and looking into all of that. So that's what, you know, we talked about earlier, all the different cultural systems. Like we just got into gender and imperialism and race and all this, like, yeah. and for something that's so simple of like,
don't hurt other people. Yeah.
All child, not just one child, you know?
Right. Right. It seems simple, but I don't know why we've made it so complex. Yeah. Yeah. You've got a chapter in the book on patriarchy, and I'll admit, like, while I was reading it, it made me a little uncomfortable and kind of defensive. And by the time I got to the end of it, I was like agreeing with everything. So you kind of talk about women as being agents of patriarchy and the main fixtures in certain systems and how that may shape men's relationship with women as adults. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So the sort of central question of that chapter is, where does that system come from? And also, can we really say that that's the system if men are being generally cut and mutilated when they're children? Like, it doesn't make sense that if there's a male dominant system that men would do that to themselves, mm-hmm. right?
Right, right.
So I was looking at it from the perspective, the whole book actually is looking at things from the perspective of children and what their mm-hmm. experience is.
Right.
And children in larger society, there might be places where men are dominant, but for children, usually it's women looking after them. And I go sure. through, even in our modern society, it's not just mothers, it's that's primarily, you know, nurses and childcare workers and mm-hmm. school teachers. And so for children, the first 18 years of their life are actually situations where women have power over them. Mm-hmm. And those are the times when people are learning their emotional way of relating. And so if in that, I mean, I even get a little bit into this in the film. People in the film talk about how circumcision is a child's first shared sexual experience. In other words, someone's touching their body.
Right.
And what are they learning from that experience? Well, they're learning that if you're bigger and stronger than someone else, you get to do what you want to their body. Because that's how it was for them growing up. And they're learning that, by the way, in their earliest days of life, when everything that they're experiencing, they're going to relate to their relationship with their mother. It's like the first male-female relationship for men. And that teaching, that experience is kind of the core of what people are talking about when they talk about patriarchy, that if you're bigger and stronger, you get to do what you want. And so men receive that very early in their childhood, in their relationships with women, and the women who raised them. And in those situations, they're a child, they can't do anything about it. They're the smaller, weaker person. But when they're the bigger, stronger person as an adult, they get to flip that dynamic. And so, one, there's sort of an incentive there of not questioning it, because when they're old enough, they have, like, those inner child parts are still in there. And the trauma reaction to all of that is, well, like, you hurt me when I was young. Maybe I'm not, maybe there's not conscious awareness of it, but now I'm in the dominant position and I'm in charge, right? Yeah. And so what I say in there is that if, when people talk about patriarchy, that's learned somewhere. And the only place it could be learned is a place where mostly women are teaching people. And that if we want to change it, we have to change how we raise children. And it's not actually, you know, because a lot of the times when people talk about this stuff, they think that the way to do that is to consciously, like, basically yell a bunch of ideas and opinions at their children. It's actually, you have to teach them through the way that you relate to them.
Right.
And the emotional way that you relate to them. So I, in most of recorded history, if you go back, you know, the further you go back, the worse it is for kids. Although I still think, even in our day and age, it's not that great.
Right.
But then you also, you can sort of see the comparison with how we treat kids and then how, when men are in power as adults, how they sort of treat other people the same way.
Right. Kind of going back to that notion of the agentic state. And I think because we are kind of one step down on the power hierarchy in medicine and education and so forth, like you were just mentioning, where women have the biggest role. Do you think, I mean, do you suppose it's kind of, again, not intentional on an individual level, but intentional in a systemic idea that women, and in a lot of cases, even people of color, are used as the agents to perpetuate the idea of patriarchy?
I feel like this, so if you think about it as a system, what's the safest for the system? The safest for the system is if it has a scapegoat, right? And with circumcision, it's often usually the parents. Oh, the parents chose this. And then the next step is the doctors and nurses. And so I definitely do feel like there are people in those positions who are used as scapegoats. And at the same time, there's complicity. In other words, they are being used as scapegoats, but they're also complicit in their role as scapegoats. In other words, if someone is a nurse or a, you know, in a position like that, and they say, well, I was just doing what the hospital told me, on one level, that's true. And on another level, they did what they told, were told to do. Right.
Right.
So in a sense, they didn't have to be complicit, but I also understand why in that situation they would be. Does that make sense?
And how do you think informed consent ties in with all of that? Because certainly parents are ultimately signing the consent forms, but at the same time, the information that they're being given largely isn't accurate.
It's neither informed nor consenting. So that's, I mean, we talk about the informed part, the everything that we're talking about now, it's not given. There's none of the other information that's in my film. But I actually don't even think there's consent. In other words, One, for you know, from the perspective of informed consent, there isn't consent if there isn't, you know, accurate information. But on another level, the parents are brought into this system and they have all this pressure placed on them and they're asked several times and the hospital won't release their child after a certain amount. And sometimes the mom is still on drugs from giving birth. Mm-hmm. And if you were to take all of that and place it in another situation, you know, if you imagine that someone was like pressuring another person for sex and they asked 8 or 9 times, and they said that bad things would happen if they didn't do it. And they had a friend of theirs or someone they care about in the next room that they wouldn't let go until later. And the other person was still on a mind-altering drug of some kind.
Right.
And they eventually said, fine, I consent. You wouldn't, that's not what consent is, right?
Right. That's coercion, not consent.
Right. It's right. So I actually think that there isn't ever parental consent in the medical system. It's always coercion because of the power difference between the two, because of the lack of information given, because of the various forms of pressure. And that saying that it's a parental choice is a way that the system hides itself.
Yeah.
In other words, okay, the parents might have signed the consent form, but they didn't train the medical staff. They didn't build the sales pipeline. They didn't construct the medical devices that are being used. They didn't create the culture that normalized it. Like, all of that was done by the system. And then at the end, the parents were like, fine, I guess. It wasn't their choice. It was the choice of a system.
Right.
That they scapegoated the parents for and said, well, you were complicit in it. So
yeah.
Not all of the responsibility. Most of the responsibilities with the system itself. And then the parents, they are responsible for their role, but that role is so much smaller, mm-hmm. so much smaller than what the system would make it out to be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You talk about how circumcision is only possible because the victims are children and the perpetrators are adults. And I often frame this, you know, when I do have conversations with people about it, is that, you know, if I were, say, sleeping with a man and decided to cut off part of his penis while he was sleeping, what would the legal ramifications of that be? And why is it different because we're doing it to a defenseless child that can't say no?
Yeah, it's worse in that case. Yeah. I feel like that's, again, goes back to people's attitudes about children. Mm-hmm. That I don't know how to phrase it. I've heard people say, like, people do not see children as people. Mm-hmm. There's an idea I ran across as I was researching different social justice concepts called internalized dominance. Mm-hmm. And internalized dominance is a word for when a dominant group sees themselves as more important or more deserving than an oppressed or minority group. In other words, we deserve this more, we earned it, we're better. The reason that we have more power or privilege is because we're just better. And we, you know, that's sort of the attitude of internalized dominance.
Okay.
And when I first kind of thought, that is exactly how people relate to children, that they see themselves as in some way more deserving or more important. And very often internalized dominance in other situations is justified by sort of like pseudo biological justifications of like, well, there's some sort of difference between us that means that this group gets to in some way be in power or something over the other group. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely true in the case of children, where people say, well, children can't take care of themselves. But there is in social justice, there's a whole class of people who sometimes can't take care of themselves. They're called the disabled, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you wouldn't say like, oh, well, that person's disabled, so we can just do it. You know, like that, the same attitude wouldn't apply there. In the case of people who can't take care of themselves, the social attitude is, well, we have a job to take care of them. We have to make accommodations for them in some way, or we have to at least ensure that we're nice to them and respect their rights, right?
Right.
So it's the same thing there where it's hard for me to describe the attitude people have towards children, but because I don't totally understand it myself. Like when I am in touch with my own feelings when I was a child, I have a child. It's very clear to me what he's expressing. Like, he's very good at expressing himself when he's happy. He makes everyone else in the room happy. And when he's upset about something, he lets you know. So
Right.
It doesn't quite make sense to me either.
Right. And I often say we really need to look more to babies, wild animals, and indigenous people to understand our true nature, because we as adults in an industrialized world have really cut ourselves off from our intuition and our natural instincts to just know what's truly right in our own nature. I wanted to ask you a little bit, because I hear, you know, especially in the film and in other arguments, you know, there's this absurd debate on whether babies feel pain or whether they feel pain during this procedure. And I think that's almost irrelevant, because it's the body. I study Eastern healing modalities, and so much of where I come to the space from now is I think that Western science is really having trouble catching up to what many of the Eastern healing modalities have known for millennia, and that the body has its own innate intelligence. And what's happening during a process where the body is being threatened is so much more complex than does it just feel physical pain or not. So when the body is being compromised in some way, there's an autonomic nervous system response that happens that gets stuck and rewires the entire energetic system of the body, potentially for a lifetime. And this is where I think so many people who have early life experiences like this or any kind of trauma end up exploring more as adults, when those energetic dysregulations start showing up as physical or mental diseases. Can you expand a little bit on that? Because I know I've explored a lot, and I think maybe it's touched on a little bit in the film, but the notion of psychosomatic disease. So the idea that these early life childhood experiences, including circumcision, but obviously not limited to that, are expressing as actual physical diseases that show up later in life as in a holistic model where different levels of toxicity and experiences build up and build up until finally the body expresses as disease at some point.
So there's a couple different things there that we could go into. First, on the subject, do babies feel pain? Yes. We talk about in the film, right. You can look up the Anand and Hickey pain studies, the Taddeo pain studies. I think the more interesting question that you brought up there is, why doesn't the medical system understand that?
Right.
And in terms of things being expressed later, there's also the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences survey, that just, they ask people, do you have early life challenging experiences? And then they notice that all of the people who have those have cancer rates higher, they have higher disease later in life, they're more likely to commit suicide, they're more likely to have mental health issues, which of course is like what you'd expect if someone was, you know, the things that they ask in the ACE study are, you know, was there sexual abuse as a child? Did a parent abandon you or have to go to jail, and all these different things. And so intuitively it makes sense, but I think the more interesting question is, why doesn't the medical system understand that? And in the book, again, I talk about a concept called the medical gaze, which again is a Michel Foucault concept. He wrote a whole book talking about the mindset of the medical system and their discourse and how they view things in isolation rather than holistically.
Correct.
So if we want to understand, does this particular trauma cause stuff later in life? Mm-hmm. It's really hard to construct a study to do that, because you would have to test that one thing in isolation and then give everybody else, everyone in the study, the same life, the same experiences. You know, people say, well, correlation isn't causation. Okay, how are you going to isolate this one element of a person's life from, and this other one element later, and eliminate everything else? You actually can't do that.
Right.
Even though it's immediately obvious to anyone who's observed human beings that people who have a lot of childhood trauma have a more challenging life later on, right? It's
right.
Just, you can all see it. But the way that the medical gaze works is that, I mean, when you and I look at each, when normal people look at each other, when most people look at each other, they see the whole person and they kind of take it all in. And what Michel Foucault writes about is that it used to be that that's the doctor, what the doctor would do. You'd have a holistic view. You'd ask, see the person sort of whole life and see everything going on with them. And that what happened at some point was that people began looking at the organs of the body in isolation. So if you come into the doctor and you have a cough or a flu, they might just look at just your throat or just your lungs. Right. And it's not what's going on with you. It's what's going on with your lungs. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with this one part of the body. Right. And when you do scientific studies, it's the same thing. So people will do a study on, you know, genital cutting or circumcision, and they'll say, well, it prevents this disease because we eliminated all the other factors and just looked at that. And for example, the studies that talk about HIV, they don't take into account that one group received sex education and used condoms at a higher rate and the other didn't, which of course anyone would be like, well, of course, using condoms at a higher rate probably reduces STDs. But if you look at only one piece of information in isolation and eliminate everything else, it creates a really skewed perspective. Mm. And so you ask, okay, well, did the children feel pain during that? I don't know. That's not what we were studying. We were only looking at this one thing, right? And so if you look at only, it's you sort of a site, it's a fragmentation of the way that they look at things.
Right.
Where instead of looking at the body holistically, they're only looking at one thing. Mm. And doing that means that they can't see the holistic impact of their actions.
Right.
In other words, to say, okay, this thing that happened in childhood might be impacting me now later in life, that's a very holistic view. You're looking at the whole of a person's life. Mm-hmm. And so if someone comes in later and they have one particular ailment, you know, they have, let's say it's like throat cancer. It's like, well, what's wrong with your throat? Not like what could be causing this generally in the whole of your life. And I think that's also why the medical system causes so many side effects. Mm-hmm. Which from a holistic perspective, they're not side effects. They're just effects, right? You did a thing and it caused an outcome. And all of the outcomes are something that you would be responsible for if from a holistic perspective, whereas from a medical perspective, well, we only intend to do the one thing. We're looking at the one thing in isolation, this like medical gaze. And it's very fragmenting because to actually understand, I was going to say someone, but anything, you need to look at the whole picture.
Right.
It can be useful to look at one part of the picture, but you do at least need to be aware there's a larger picture. Mm-hmm. And that fragmentation, that medical gaze is also what I think allows for them to do other things, like the way that they harm children. In other words, when the early sort of campaign against masturbation occurred, they're looking at one thing. They're looking at, can we stomp out this one practice and not how is this transforming society and people and their relationship to their children and the doctor's relationship to the child. From a larger perspective, I think there's some unconscious awareness of it. And of course, in the history when, you know, they talk about wanting power over children, but in the, like the way that they're training the everyday practitioner, they need them to just do one thing, only see the one thing and ignore the larger system, the man behind the curtain, the
right. Everything else. Right.
So you ask, like, well, why don't they see the holistic perspective? Because they're trained not to look at things in isolation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're trying to study things in isolation, a view that isn't holistic isn't going to be able to see what is holistic.
Right. Can you tell us how long has circumcision been the norm in the United States?
So it began as a medical practice in the Victorian era, so late 1800s.
Okay.
It's relatively recent. Even the version that we do has changed. So during the version that Americans do was taken from Jewish circumcision, but Jewish circumcision itself transformed in the Hellenistic period and actually used to be less severe than it is now. But the medical practice is relatively new. It's the past 100 years.
Okay. And the reason I ask that is I think most people don't realize the transformation that the medical system and particularly the doctor-patient relationship and the doctor's office business structure has changed, particularly in the last 100 years. And we've gone from a medical system where doctors largely worked independently in their own individual practices and have now merged into these large medical industrial complex conglomerates where they have to, by and large, practice to the, I'm using air quotes here, standard of care. So now we have doctors who aren't necessarily doctoring, but they're employees of large healthcare systems. How do you think that impacts the systemic problem that we're seeing of this perpetuating to be the norm?
I mean, you answered it in the question before. Okay. There wasn't a system, and now there is a system.
Yeah.
If someone was an individual single practice doctor, they would be responsible for what they did because mm-hmm. there's no one above them.
Right.
And if they're just an agent of a system, they can say, well, what I was doing was the standard of care, and they can pass that responsibility in some way. Mm-hmm. And in some way, I understand how it got that way. So the evidence-based medicine, or what people call evidence-based medicine, right. is again, actually a relatively new practice. Mm-hmm. In other words, it used to be that the doctor would do what they had learned in their personal experience treating lots of people for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then you would sort of an apprenticeship system. Mm-hmm. And that changed. It's hard for me to talk about this because I'm still learning some of this history myself.
Sure.
But then it became, well, we have to do what the large randomized controlled studies did at some point in history. And so I sort of understand why it went that way, because prior, medicine was viewed as more of an art, and you had a lot of different doctors doing different things.
Right.
And so there was this idea, well, let's look at all of that and figure out the one thing that works. Mm-hmm. And to a certain degree, that's useful. And then to another degree, one that gives a lot of power to whoever controls those academic journals and studies.
Right.
And also, human bodies are different. And there might be something that's uniquely going on with you.
Right.
It's different than what happened in all those randomized controlled trials.
Right.
And so there's different forms of power created. I mean, I don't think the previous system where it was treated as an art form is exactly better.
Sure.
You know, there's a saying that today's problem was yesterday's solution. Mm-hmm. So there's like, oh, well, we'll create a big system, and then everybody will follow the system and the system will work. And now there's a big system and everyone's following the system and it's not working. So yeah. The answer is sort of in the question of like, well, before there wasn't a system, and there mm-hmm. might've been problems with that. And now there is a system and there's problems with that.
Yeah. I've read somewhere that the human brain is only capable of managing basically 12 times 12. So 144 different relationships at any given time. So anytime we get a system that is larger than about 150 people, it starts to become dehumanizing, where we're not capable of even seeing the individual more. And we have a more, especially in this case, epidemiological sort of framework for viewing things, looking at people collectively rather than as their individual needs. So I think that's part of the problem. Back to that notion of evidence-based medicine, you talk about in the book, the power of language. And I feel like that term in particular, not that it doesn't have any validity to it, but I feel like it has been co-opted almost for marketing purposes. And we've so veered away from the idea of experience-based medicine in favor of people funneling into that.
Well, the term itself implies a lot, right? Like, if what you're doing is evidence-based medicine, is what other people doing like made up imaginary medicine?
Right. You know?
After finishing the book, and I've started writing online on a site called hegemonmedia.com. Mm-hmm. I came across this idea from Confucius called the rectification of names that I found mm-hmm. really interesting. And what he says is like ancient Chinese philosophy thousands of years ago. He says, someone asked him, if you assumed power, if you had power, what's the first thing you'd do? He said, I would give things their proper names. Because mm-hmm. if things don't have their proper names, then the good and the moral isn't done. Mm-hmm. And I found that so interesting, because at the same time that I was studying modern social justice stuff, of course, modern social justice is all about language. Like, there's all sorts of different things that you're supposed to do with language and that. And the reason for that is they actually believe that language creates power. Mm-hmm. In other words, if we call it evidence-based medicine, then that implies a certain moral and intellectual response to it. Okay. If we call it corporate industrialized medicine, then there's a completely different moral and intellectual reaction we need to have to it. And actually, what name we call it will determine everything else. If we say that it is the standard of care, there's one reaction. If we say that it's sexual assault or that it's genital mutilation, there's a different reaction.
Exactly.
And that's just the name.
Right.
And so part of the reason that people, I think, sometimes don't find it as easy to talk about this is that all of the names they've been given are wrong. Uh-huh. So
I think the term healthcare in and of itself is a misnomer, right? There's a sick care system that most of us are participating in. If we really want to create a healthcare system, we're talking about something completely different.
Even, you know, we're talking about circumcision. It's referred to as a medical practice done on a patient. Mm-hmm. I never signed into the hospital as a child, right? Like, mm-hmm. I didn't agree to this. Mm-hmm. So who's the patient? Well, they'll say, right. Well, the parents, but like, that's not who you're operating. So there's all this, even to talk about it, you have to actually change the language.
Exactly.
And if you use the old language, it reinforces the previous power structure, right? Uh-huh. So if we say we're against evidence-based medicine, well, you're against evidence.
Right.
You know, like, no, we're against this giant right. corporate structure. So we have to call it the giant, the system, so to speak.
Right. So the language itself seems to be structured to marginalize anybody who would like to speak out against it or propose a different structure.
The language, what Michel Foucault calls it in his philosophy, is power knowledge, mm-hmm. meaning that there is a set of language and knowledge that creates power, and that power in turn creates knowledge. Mm-hmm. So there's this huge system, the entire medical system, it creates all this language, and that language is in turn intended to protect the system. Yeah. And even you being able to talk about the feelings you had around your own experience, mm-hmm. it sounds like that you had to bring some of the language that exists around survivors of sexual assault
yeah.
and trauma-informed healing.
Yeah.
So you had to find an entirely different language system to talk about because you exactly. couldn't in their system.
Right.
And I couldn't either about my own experiences.
Right, right. And I think in both of those instances, you know, adults going on journeys to kind of heal whatever happened to them in childhood, just being able to find the right healthcare partners to help them unearth that stuff and give the proper language to is a journey unto itself.
By the way, that is part of the reason I use the language of social justice in my book and mm-hmm. that term.
Yeah.
Even if we call it human rights is the domain of the state. It's okay. their state's job to protect your rights to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. If we call it social justice, it's our job to do it.
Yeah.
And there's an entirely different way that the dominant culture treats and reacts to social justice issues mm-hmm. than it does to all of the other different types of language. If we were to call it men's rights, that's mm-hmm. a totally different thing. If we were to call it something around consent, that's totally different. But social justice is the area where there's an understanding that people can say and do a lot for social justice issues they couldn't do for other things.
Yeah.
And there's also an understanding, by the way, that everyone has a responsibility on those issues.
Yeah.
In other words, if someone says, well, I'm just doing my job, we know how that looks from a social justice perspective when someone says that, right?
Yeah. So kind of summing up here, how do we use the perspective of critical theory or social justice as the framework to create solutions surrounding health rights and especially children's justice within the medical system?
So the first thing is to change the language. Actually, can I go really weird and political with this answer?
Absolutely. Let's go.
All right. So I was reading recently Lenin's book, Vladimir Lenin, Architect of the Russian Revolution, What is to be Done? The Burning Questions of Our Movement. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book where he lays out, he's like, everyone is doing it wrong. This is how you do change in the world. Mm-hmm. And then he did exactly what he said he was going to do in the book and overthrew the largest landmass in the world and established a giant, the first communist state. So reading that, I was like, oh my goodness, I understand why this worked. Like he just sat and came up with this theory and then implied it and took over a country. So mm-hmm. it's very simple, three steps. First, he says you need to understand the theory mm-hmm. and everyone who's in leadership and trying to change things needs to understand theory. And it's interesting reading his stuff because he viewed communism or Marxism very differently than we might now. He says, like, this is like a better economic system. Like, now people sort of make moral arguments around that and say, oh, it's somehow more fair. But at the time, he's like, no, this is actually going to create more wealth for everyone. Of course, that's not exactly how it played out.
Right.
But that was the thinking at the time, right? So you understand the theory, mm-hmm. and then you apply the theory. So everyone, if we understand that this is a better way of doing things, then we need to start applying it. And then the third step is every chance you get, agitate for the theory. Mm-hmm. So at the time, that would be, you know, oh, you guys don't have healthcare. The reason you don't have healthcare is you don't have socialism, right? Mm-hmm. If you had that, you'd have it. Oh, you guys are working long hours. You don't get to see your families. The reason you don't have that is you don't have, you know, every chance you're agitating for that. And I think that that method has been applied by every political revolutionary movement to come after him. Mm-hmm. In other words, oh, you're being mistreated by in your relationship. That's because you don't have feminism. You need that. Oh, right. Oh, you're not being accepted for your sexuality. That's because you don't have gender theory and gay rights. Oh, because you can apply the same thing to cultural issues. Right. It's almost the always be selling of political theory. Mm-hmm. Like, it's actually weirdly similar to sales when you look at his method.
Right.
And so, when you first asked, like, well, how is it we actually implement this? I was going to say the first thing you need to do is look at the language mm-hmm. And it actually mirrors to his first point of understanding theory. In other words, if you feel intuitively that there's something wrong or that something happened to you, in order to express that, in order to talk about it, you need some way of understanding it. And that is what theory or writing provides. Now, I think that theory, you know, I'm using as an example a theory that I suspect most people don't agree with at this point, which is, you know, his theory. But for us, something like this understanding that's created through holistic medicine, through trauma recovery stuff. I mean, in my own work, I draw heavily from people who have done research on early childhood trauma, like Alice Miller. I pull from people like Lloyd DeMoss, who wrote about psychohistory. I pull from a whole lot of trauma recovery stuff. And so those theories are part of what inform my own understanding. And then I also draw from people who've done stuff around political theory and how power works and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So if you understand a particular theory and you have an understanding of why this happened to you, of what happened to you, of what that means. And I would also add to that understanding within, understanding mm-hmm. your own feelings, being present with them, then you can apply it. So in the case of this, there's applying the healing to yourself, but there's also applying the way that you interact with others, with systems. So if you understand the medical system the way that we do, you're going to interact with it very differently. And then the last part, the part that actually creates revolution, is agitating for it every chance you get, mm-hmm. spreading that message, contributing to people and organizations that are trying to create that change. And the way that I apply it in my own work is if I'm using that same sort of formula, and I actually do think this is true, is, mm-hmm. oh, the reason that you feel the way you do, that's because there's been trauma.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the thing I think we need to solve. And that trauma, by the way, can manifest in all sorts of different systems. It might manifest through gender inequality or economic issues or all these other things that people talk about politically. But at the root, I think the only reason that people can even, that they don't rebel against those systems is because at some point in their lives, they learned a way of relating where it seemed okay. And I think the place where most people learn is childhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
So read, learn, study theory. Yeah. You can get my book. That's a good place to start if you want to learn more stuff. You can listen absolutely. To podcasts like this. Then you start applying it in your own mm-hmm. life and then agitate for it in the world as much as possible.
And on the agitation note, I'll kind of note in dominant medical culture, there's usually about a 20-year curve of when we first understand a new concept in medicine to when it actually starts to finally get implemented into the medical yep. culture. I mean, we can look at, you know, doctors who used to tell people which brand of cigarettes to smoke. We can look at the concept of the microbiome, which we're about 20 years into really understanding that. And it's finally become something that's a fixture in even conventional medicine now. So I feel like you kind of ignited this movement in terms of intactivism, or at least bringing enough agitation to it and putting it in front of enough people. So maybe we're about 5 years into that.
I didn't ignite it. I just agitated.
You did. You definitely agitated it. So kudos to you for that. And hopefully we will get to the end of that 20-year cycle and this will be a thing of the past. But in the meantime, I really appreciate the work you're doing, both on the intactivism front, but also just generally speaking in terms of creating a greater awareness about holistic modalities of healing and trauma-informed work. So thank you so much for your work. Where can people find you online and how can they get a copy of the book?
So everything's on my website, brennamorata.com, and I'm also writing on hegemonmedia.com. You can subscribe there and get articles from me every week. I will add, I feel like the stuff with children's justice is a little bit different than intactivism.
Okay.
But we're all trying to create the same thing. So
yeah, definitely.
I say that because children's justice gets into a whole bunch of other stuff. And
absolutely.
If we're being technical about it, there's a slight difference.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Did you hear that thunder that just came through?
No.
Oh man.
It's a sign.
It is a sign. I recorded a whole podcast on this during a thunderstorm, this particular mic, and none of that got on the audio.
But yeah. All right.
Maybe it's a sign for me and me alone. We'll see. But yes, hegemonmedia.com is the place if you want regular writing from me, and brennamorata.com is the place to find my book, which is also on Amazon.
Okay.
I also have a podcast of my own that I'll be getting back to soon at some point. And read that. Congratulations. You're all revolutionaries now. Overthrow the system and good luck.
Absolutely. I will put all those in the show notes. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate the conversation.
Thanks for having me on.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Any statements and views expressed by myself or my guests are not medical advice. The opinions of guests are their own, and the Body Literacy Podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. If you have a medical problem, please consult a qualified and competent medical professional. As always, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Body Literacy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe and sign up for updates over at jenmayo.com.